This is New America Now. Dispatches from the New Majority. I'm Sandeep Roy. Coming up, who's the weakest link? Al Jazeera and the WikiLeaks.
With the leak of these U.S. cables, Al Jazeera took the driver's back seat.
The Somali-American community grapples with one of its own, accused in a bombing plot.
If you are in ocean, you can't be dry. You will be part of that ocean, whether you like it or not.
Who's sari now? Performance artist Shailja Patel uses colourful saris to spin a darker tale.
So the audience doesn't actually get to see the full contents of the saris till the final scene, when they've sat through tales of torture.
And the best young novelists in Spanish, and they aren't writing about military dictators or magical realism.
I've always sort of been suspicious of write what you know. I think you should write what you want to know.
This week on Ethnic Media Watch, WikiLeaking in Manila, and Asian American students respond to gay bashing. Joining us from Fresno, Maider Vang, and from New York, Anthony Advincula. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Sandeep.
Thank you, Sandeep. Hello.
The last couple of months, the stories of teenagers who've committed suicide because of gay bullying has really dominated the media, and it resulted in this video project called It Gets Better by columnist Dan Savage, who to give lesbian gay teens hope. And now the Pacific Citizen newspaper has apparently written about how Asian American youth are trying to make it better. And Maider, you've been reading it. What are Asian Americans doing?
Right. A lot of Asian American youth are taking a stand and sharing their stories, especially if they've, been a victim of bullying. And so they're using technology and using YouTube as a way to share their stories with other young people across the nation.
Well, some of the criticism, though, of the project It Gets Better and the YouTube videos it's produced is that it's all well and good, that it gets better eventually. But what about now? Are there things schools could be doing now? Did the people who were interviewed for this story address that?
You know, that's always a common concern, is that, you know, you don't want to prolong the experience of bullying, especially if you're a young person who's in that position. And so some of the suggestions are that, you know, people shouldn't be afraid to talk about it, whether they are the bully themselves or whether they're the ones who are experiencing it from someone else. And so giving people a space to be able to talk about it and be open about it is always the first step, is what the article shares.
Can you share one of the stories of the people profiled in the articles who might have put out these videos to help people?
So there's the story of Crystal Yoneta, who is currently 27 years old now, but she tells her story of what it was like for her when she was in high school and she was taunted with slurs like dyke and things that made her really feel discouraged. You know, she shares her video online and tells her story with other young people, and as a result of that, she sort of became like an online counselor to other bully victims who contacted her and wanted to get advice on how they should deal with their own experience. And so it's been kind of a really powerful tool for young people to engage and to share their stories, but also find support.
Is there any sense, Maider, that because these young people from Asian American communities, that their culture and, you know, how Asian American communities regard issues around, like, homosexuality adds another layer of complication to the story?
It's really interesting because in the article, the Reverend Jennifer Kwong of API Equality in LA points out that a lot of Asian Pacific Islanders are sometimes afraid to talk about these issues because they don't want to cause shame on the family. And so that might contribute to the fear around wanting to even talk about it. And so, you know, she points out that there is no shame in it, and that we need to do a better job of being able to have people share their stories, whether they're the bully or whether they're the victim of it.
Well, I was amazed to read that in 2004, it was a while back, the California Safe Schools Coalition did a survey and said that some 200,000 California high school and middle school students reported being harassed because of their perceived or actual sexual orientation. So given those kinds of numbers, you know, California has these laws like Student Safety and Violence Prevention Act or Safe Place to Learn Act. Did you get a sense from the story about whether students felt they really worked in protecting them?
You know, that's really interesting because, you know, these laws are there for a reason. But there are a lot of young people out there, like in the story, a 16-year-old Kamiki Nichitsui points out that, you know, even though these laws are in place, they don't always get implemented in the right ways. And so sometimes they're not effective in preventing bullying from happening.
Well, let's switch gears right now to talk about the WikiLeaks story. And we're going to talk about the WikiLeaks and the Arab press later in the program, but let's turn to another part of the world first. So of the 250,000 U.S. State Department cables that were leaked by WikiLeaks, about 1,796 were from the U.S. Embassy in Manila. Now, at this time when we are speaking, we don't know actually what's in those particular cables because those ones haven't been released yet. But Anthony, what's been the reaction in the Filipino press to the impending release of these cables?
Well, Sadiq, while none of these documents were from the U.S. Embassy in Manila, the 220 documents that have already been uploaded onto the WikiLeaks website, the curiosity about the contents of these documents is killing the Philippine government officials. Even the Philippine President Ninoy Aquino Jr. said that there could be danger that the information in these communications would not be understood properly. But earlier today, the Philippine Department of Foreign Affairs in Manila said that it is premature to tell what effects the leaked memos would have on relations with the United States once these are published online. So there are so many information and reactions, and many Filipinos here and in the Philippines are conflicted about this leakage.
Well, the U.S. Embassy in Manila is ranked number 44 among the 274 embassies and consulates that have the most cables in the leak. So 44 is pretty high up there. It's in the top 50. So given U.S.-Philippines relations, what do you think the Philippine government is most nervous about?
Well, the White House spokesman, Edwin Lacerda, told the Filipino media that while the documents may not contain information involving the Philippines, the leaks might affect the privacy of communication between the two countries. And he also said that if there will be an embarrassment that should result from the release of the classified documents, it would be from the end of the Americans. But interestingly, many believe, especially the ones who are here in the United States, they're saying that the Philippine government should not dip its fingers into the WikiLeaks controversy because the Philippine government has nothing to do with it or how they came out. But some of the concerned individuals, whatever the agenda of WikiLeaks, they're saying that it could affect the diplomatic relations or even the backlash against Filipino immigrants in the United States.
What are some of the most contentious issues between the U.S. and Philippines right now? What could be the most controversial things?
Well, the most controversial issue is the U.S. military presence in the Philippines, especially in the southern part of the country. While they're saying that the U.S. Military cannot participate in any combative action, Filipino officials are saying that this is just a facade, that whatever happens, you know, the U.S. military could actually enforce or participate in any combative action against what they so-called the Al-Qaeda-linked extremist group, the Abu Sayyaf presence in the southern islands of the Philippines.
So right now, the WikiLeaks covers the period between 1996 and February of this year. So in a sense, Anthony, does President Ninoy Aquino have some cover since he was actually not president in February? And so he could claim that, you know, whatever the U.S. and the consular embassy in Manila is saying, it doesn't really affect him.
He didn't say anything. He didn't issue any statement about it. He was just concerned that it could actually affect the privacy of communication between the United States and the Philippines. But in the Philippine media, they're saying that the Philippine government should definitely not censor these documents because the Filipinos, even the documents happened in the past administration, they're saying that the Filipinos have the right to know what are the contents of those documents, especially the information about political leaders in the past and how they ran the Philippines.
Well, especially given that the U.S. and the Filipino political leaders in the past have had had a sometimes cozy and sometimes controversial relationship.
Exactly.
Well, we'll be watching to see what's in those 1,796 cables leaked by WikiLeaks, but thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maider Vang coordinates the KNOW, a youth media program based in Fresno. Anthony Advincula monitors ethnic media for New America Media from New York City. This is New America Now. I'm Sandeep Roy. WikiLeaks of more than 250,000 U.S. diplomatic cables left many in Washington with red faces this week. The news item that dominated the coverage in media was that the Saudi king had urged Washington to cut off the head of the snake by destroying Iran's nuclear program. We asked New America Media's Arab Media Monitor Jalal Ghazi about how Arab media like Al Jazeera were reporting this story. We reached him at the offices of New America Media. Jalal, before we discuss how Al Jazeera covered these WikiLeaks, tell us how they covered the leaks the last time around when the revelations were about civilian deaths in Iraq and state torture and things like that.
Well, Al Jazeera took a leading role in analyzing, examining the Iraqi secret files. And their tremendous effort has resulted in finding a great insight about the civilian casualties, and which forced the body count to actually increase the number of Iraqi civilians that were killed during the war in Iraq. Also, their examination of these files led to revelations about the United States' role in the torture that was conducted by Iraqis against Iraqis, and how the United States forces knew about it and reported about it, but nothing has happened. However, this time around, with the leak of these U.S. cables, Al Jazeera took the driver's back seat.
Took the back seat. You say, in fact, in an article that the coverage of the WikiLeaks on Al Jazeera shows Al Jazeera's Achilles heel. How did they cover it or not cover it?
They did not take a leading role. They basically, their reporting was shallow for the most part. And many of the articles they published on Al Jazeera Net were basically translations and abbreviations of articles that already appeared in Los Angeles Times and as well as New York Times. So one really has to ask the question, why Al Jazeera refrained from playing a stronger role this time? And why didn't dig deep into these leaked U.S. cables? And there's a lot of materials to be studied and analyzed. And the question, the answer that comes to mind, of course, is the scandal, the exposure that these cables have provided, not only about Saudi Arabia, which is not surprising what they've said about Iran, although one has to stop and think about Saudi's urging for using military strike against Iran, but however, this view is shared by all Gulf countries, including Qatar, and this is the big surprise.
Qatar is, of course, where Al Jazeera is based.
Yeah.
So what do the cables, what connections do the cables have between the Emir of Qatar and his attitudes towards Iran?
Well, you see, Al Jazeera has always had more friendly coverage about Iran than other Arabic televisions, specifically Al Arabiya, which is heavily financed by Saudi. And also the relationship between the Qatari emir and between Iran is very close. By far, is the closest than any other Arab country in the Gulf. So the leaked cables show that there is mistrust, hidden mistrust, and show that, for example, some of the leaked cables, Qatari Emir says to the United States, the relationship between us and Iran is based on they lie to us and we lie to them. And also he says, out of the 100 words they tell us, we don't believe a word. So these sort of statements, they really...
So they contradict the public face that that Qatar wants to put out there about its cordial relations with Iran. Now, Qatar is right next to Iran. Why does Qatar, at least on the public surface, want to maintain the appearance of friendly relations with Iran? What does it stand to gain or lose?
Because Iran has great control over the shared oil, natural gas fields offshore. You know, there's a few offshore natural gas fields, and they're huge, and the Qatari livelihood depends on them and depends on Iranian cooperation. And if Iran choose to, it could make life very difficult for Qatar. Also, the Qatari plays a very delicate balancing act. On the one hand, they mistrust Iran, but they really want to have good relationship with them. And this is why one has to really stop at these cables, because for Qatari government, good relationship with Iran is really their security. Now it's really a big embarrassment for them trying to put a positive spin on these leaks and trying to tell the Iranians we're really friends after this mistrust that we've seen in these cables.
But at the same time as Qatar wants to preserve good relations with Iran, Qatar has also, there is a big military base which the U.S. used for attacks into Iraq, and Qatar has helped keep it there.
Yes, of course. And this Odeid military base is the largest U.S. military base in the Gulf. And you could also say that this base is part of Qatari balancing act in a sense that we have good relationship with Iran, but if things go sour, we really have the United States here to protect us. So the presence of the United States is really a balancing act against Iran. But the point is, the Al Jazeera, and this is what we're really talking about, by far, is it provided the better coverage of any other Arab television when it comes to Palestine, when it comes to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. But this is its weakness here. This is their blind spot. They definitely cannot criticize the Emir of Qatar, and also they cannot provide critical information about Iran. When we're talking about the Iranian elections, when we're talking about the Iranian oppression of a Rouge Arab population in a region called Khuzestan, which is between the borders between Iran and Iraq, as well as the Iranian occupation of three United Arab Emirates in the Straits of Hormuz. So this is really what these leaked cables have highlighted, which is the blind spots of Al Jazeera.
So do you think, Jalal, that the Al Jazeera as a news organization will have its credibility somewhat compromised as a result of this?
I think Al Jazeera will still be the most watched Arab television. However, it's really interesting to look at how these leaked cables affected the Arab perception of Al Jazeera. I think Arabs, if they want to watch about critical reports about Iran and what's happening in Iran, probably they will turn into other Arab televisions, as well as when they want to hear something about how democratic is Qatar, they will probably listen to Al Arabiya or probably listen to other Arab television, because they don't expect Al Jazeera to provide objective information on this regard. Having said that, it would really be unfair for me to say still Al Jazeera provide a qualitative news on other issues. I mean, it's really, after all, who can say there is one television that is not biased at all? It's just really interesting to know what their biases are and to go from there.
In the rest of the Arab world, Al Jazeera aside, many of the media are state controlled. They also played down these somewhat embarrassing leaks about Arab attitudes towards a fellow Muslim country. In general, Jalal, is there a sense, is there a blogosphere or anywhere else that this story is getting out, or is this story not being covered in the Arab media at all?
Again, like you said, because they are state-sponsored, so you really have to go to specific televisions to listen to what you want to listen to. Because Qatar, for example, has animosity with Saudi Arabia, so if you go to the Qatari television or to Al Jazeera television or Al Jazeera website, you will see the statement that the Saudi described the government, the Iran, as the head as the snake, the head of the snake. And you will see the Saudis and Bahrain urging the United States to take a military strike. This, however, will not find it in Saudi sponsored media such as Al-Sharq Al-Awsat or Al Arabiya television. Again, if you look, for example, Al-Quds al-Arabi, which is a pan-Arab international newspaper based in London, you'll find strong criticism against the statements, the hypocritic statements. This is how they were described. They were said by Arab leaders in the Gulf against Iran. But then, so this is how it goes in the Middle East, where the state-sponsored media is the dominant form.
Julian Assange of WikiLeaks recently just spoke by digital video conference during the third annual conference for Arab investigative journalists. Why do you know why he did that and what he said to them?
Exactly for the reason that we'll be talking about, because he understands that in the Middle East, it's mainly state-sponsored media, and the nature of these leaked cables means that some investigative journalist has to dig in them and be critical of these government, and this is not going to happen even by, you know, quote, independent TV as Al Jazeera, because yes, Al Jazeera is more independent than others, but there's these weak spots that it cannot, you know, cross that red line. I believe that he made these statements to independent journalists, and he's hoping that this information will be picked up by them and analyzed and used to provide information to the Arab public as well as like he did in the West.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Jalal.
You're welcome.
Jalal Ghazi writes the Eye on the Middle East column for New America Media. You can read his latest column about the WikiLeaks on newamericanow.org. You're listening to New America Now. I'm Sandeep Roy. For more stories, visit us on the web at newamericanow.org. Last week, 19-year-old Somali-American student Mohamed Osman Mohamed was arrested for his alleged involvement in a terrorist attack in Portland, Oregon. His lawyers say it was FBI entrapment. His mother is worried for her child. But there are tens of thousands of Americans who are also intimately involved in Mohammed's case, the Somali-American community. Journalist and community leader Mohammed Yusuf is the editor of the Somali-American community news service, Runta News. He's been watching the case closely and has even been in touch with the student's family. He spoke to New America Media's Shireen Sadeghi.
Mr. Yusuf, thank you for joining us on the program. Let's get into your unique position. You're one of the few people who has actually spoken to the student's parents. You spoke to his father and his mother in the days after the arrest. Can you tell us what they've told you?
In fact, you know, they are not talking about that much of the issue, and they have asked us to, you know, show support and come to their aid. And now we are working as a Seattle community to go and send group to show our support, both the community and the family. So, and they are talking about the case that they left for the lawyer, but so far, you know, they are only talking, you know, to get from us emotional support.
And how are they getting emotional support? Are they telling you how they feel?
In fact, you know, whoever, you know, and this kind of incident, you know, happened to, will feel, you know, bad. And this was a young, bright student who was going to college. And all of a sudden, you know, this happened to him. You can imagine if he was, you know, a street boy who was involved with violence before and drag on. But this was kind of a, you know, outgoing child going to college. And all of a sudden, this news came on the radio and on the TV and the papers. So it's a shock.
Was his mother surprised?
Very surprised, you know, and they were not expecting this kind of, you know, thing will happen to their child. And to the community, too. So the community, all of them are shocked. And even beyond, I think all Somalis, wherever they are so shocked because the Somalis in here also support back home. And the lifeline of the U.S., nobody wanted to be spoiled. So this is bad news for everyone, whether in the U.S. or back in home.
How did his father find out that he's been arrested?
You know, when I spoke to him, you know, he told me last time he spoke to was that he's coming from college and heading to home. And he was waiting. And all of a sudden now, he just found he was in the news.
Well, the reason why I'm asking about his family situation is that, as you may have heard, there are reports that the tensions in the families had led to the father actually reporting his son to authorities. What do you know about that?
You know, there are rumors like that. Some people say the mother, some people say the father. And we don't know nobody, you know, now for sure who said and give the leak. But that's all about rumors. And we will see, you know, how the case develops in this court.
Well, tell me a little bit about the student himself, his personality. Was he very Somalian? Was he religious? Was he attending the mosque regularly? Did he speak Somalian? Tell us a little bit about him.
People, you know, I talked to a good friend of mine who lives in Portland, and we talk, you know, and very often on the phone. He told me, you know, he sometimes even go to bars. You know, we don't sure if he do drinks, which, you know, and prohibited in our religion. But, you know, if you do Bali, then means, you know, you can do everything else, you know, like hanging with girls and maybe smoking, maybe drinking. But he wasn't a very religious person, even religious, I would say that. So he was just a typical American boy, like every American.
So I think that that's indicative of perhaps the Somali-American value system. You're saying that there are rumors that he perhaps drank alcohol. Would that be considered bad?
Very. You know, very to the and families and the parents and the elders, because, you know, alcohol is what we call haram, means prohibited in Islam. And if you involve alcoholic thing, that means, you know, it can lead you in other bad things. So it's very bad, yeah.
So this is reflective of a recent news item about young Somali gang members in the Minneapolis area. They were charged with human trafficking, these young gang members. Is this a problem in the Somali-American community with young people?
Yes, of course it's a problem, you know, and our young right now, you know, involve prostitution and trafficking and drugs and alcohol, violent, everything they involve. It's a disappointment to the community because we are not only here for ourselves, we are here for the whole community back home and the whole country, and we were trying to support that country and bring it up from its knees. You know, that's what we are dreaming about. We are not dreaming about, you know, to have a kids in here and then watch them destroy their lives and, you know, become violent and drug users and alcoholic. That's not what we were expecting from our kids. But, you know, when we say, if you are in ocean, you cannot be dry. You will be part of that ocean, whether you like it or not. So that means, you know, we are on a drop, and we are right now sometimes, you know, disappointed when we see kids like this.
There are tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Somali Americans in the United States. As a community leader in these recent days, how would you describe that your community feels about what has happened?
It worries a lot. Many people, you know, it worries. And today when I spoke to Casey, the guy in Portland, we're going to meet definitely soon, and we're going to talk about this and how we're going to face and approach. So that's our main concern. And still we have a meeting going on day in and day out.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Youssef, for your time.
You're welcome, Shireen.
Muhammad Youssef is the editor of the Somali American news service, Runta News. He spoke to New America Media's Shireen Sadeghi. You're listening to New America Now, dispatches from the new majority on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Sandeep Roy. For more stories, visit us on the web at newamericanow.org. The U.S. calls itself a nation of migrants, but its policies display a tremendous ambivalence about immigrants. Performance artist and poet Shailja Patel addresses those contradictions head-on in her one-woman show, Migritude. It unravels like a sari on stage, telling the stories of women and immigrants striding across borders, straddling empires, learning and unlearning history. Patel, born in Kenya of Indian heritage, has performed Migritude all over the world, from the World Social Forum in Nairobi to Florence, Italy. Now it's a book, Migritude. Welcome to the show, Shailja Patel, and congratulations.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, your one-woman show is based in ways around a suitcase of saris. What's the story behind that?
My mother began collecting saris for me when I was an infant to give to me when I got married as my trousseau. A few years ago, she gave up on me getting married anytime soon and said, take your saris. So I had this suitcase full of exquisite saris, which I wasn't using, I wasn't wearing, and I felt very guilty about that, leaving them sitting there gathering dust. So I began to think, how could I use these in my life as an activist, as an artist? Around that time, I met Kim Cook, who would become my director and creative partner on Migritude. I told her I was thinking of creating a one-woman show, and she had directed theatre, helped other spoken word artists move into theatre. And she said, well, what would this show be about? And I said, it'll be about empire and colonialism. And she said, is there anything else? And I said, the South Asian diaspora. And later she said to me, you know, she'd heard that so much. Every earnest young poet of color wants to do work about identity, about politics, but that's not actually a story that makes good theater. And so she said, is there anything else? And I said, well, I have this suitcase full of saris, and if we could use them in some way. And that was the magic spark.
So what was your relationship to saris when you were growing up?
I hated them. I associated them with constriction, with having my legs hobbled, with a traditional model of womanhood, servitude, silence, all the things that I rejected as a young feminist.
And did your mother wear a lot of saris?
My mother was a pretty modernized Western woman. So in her daily life, she wore trousers. And for her, that was really a hallmark of liberation, being a woman who wore trousers and chose Western clothing. But for traditional occasions, for social occasions, she wore saris. And when she dressed in a sari, she was extraordinarily regal and beautiful. So it was also a transformation.
Now, there are a lot of books that have come out recently by South Asian women, and many of them have saris on the cover. And sometimes it's just a body draped in a sari and you don't even see the head anymore in the cover. So were you concerned at all that just in using saris in your show, a lot of people would miss the point of the show because they were just wrapped up in how beautiful the sari was?
Well, yeah, the sari trope is definitely out there as a stereotype. For me, the saris were partly a allure. One of the cynical ways I talked about the show was come for the saris, stay for the politics. But the whole thrust of the show was to unpack what lay underneath the saris. So the audience doesn't actually get to see the full contents of the saris till the final scene when they've sat through tales of torture, tales of incarceration, tales of war, brutality, colonial violence. So the idea was to make them earn the right to the beauty, the experience of beauty, the experience of sensuality by understanding the real cost.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the book, which is from the play.
This is from Shilling Love, Part 1. They never said they loved us. Those words were not in any language spoken by my parents. I love you, honey, was the dribbled caramel of Hollywood movies, Dallas, dynasty, where electricity surged 24 hours a day through skyscrapers. Hot water gushed at the touch of gleaming taps. Banquets obscene as the Pentagon were mere backdrops, where emotions had no consequences. Words cost nothing, meant nothing, would never have to be redeemed. My parents didn't speak that language. 1975, 15 Kenyan shillings to the British pound. My mother speaks battle, storms the bastions of Nairobi's most exclusive prep schools, hurls our cowering six-year-old bodies like cannonballs into the all-white classrooms, scales the ramparts of class distinction around Loreto Convent, where the president sends his daughter, the foreign diplomats send their daughters, because my mother's daughters will have world-class educations. She falls, regroups, falls and regroups in endless assaults on visa officials who sneer behind their bulletproof windows at British and US consulates. My mother, the general, arms her daughters to take on every citadel. 1977, 20 Kenyan shillings to the British pound. My father speaks stoic endurance. He began at 16 the brutal apprenticeship of a man who takes care of his own, relinquished dreams of pilot, rally driver, for the daily crucifixion of wringing profit from underneath cars. My father, the foot soldier, bound to an honour deeper than any currency. You must finish what you start. You must march until you drop. You must give your life for those you bring into the world. I try to explain love in shillings to those who've never gauged who gets to leave, who has to stay, who breaks free and what they pay, those who've never counted love in every rung of the ladder from survival to choice. A force as grim and determined as a boot up the backside, a spur that draws blood, a mountaineer's rope that yanks relentlessly up.
Thank you. That's Shailja Patel reading from Migritude, her new book based on her one-woman show. Shailja, you know, that section starts by saying they never said they loved us. And as a South Asian, I can relate to that. This is not something that comes easily. When you came to the U.S. and you started talking, and you see love everywhere so openly professed in culture, mm-hmm. and you had relationships of your own here, mm-hmm. was that a difficult thing to explain to people about how you can love people without saying they never loved us?
Absolutely. That was actually the genesis of this piece, because I was taking a hike with someone I was dating and I was trying to explain my childhood to him. And I was talking about the political extremity in Kenya during the 80s and 90s, the economic hardship, how hard my parents had sacrificed for us. And so the tremendous sense of obligation I felt to succeed, to achieve, to repay them. And he said, "My God, your childhood sounds so terrible." And I was shocked because I thought I had been showing him how deeply I was loved. But he couldn't hear love. He could only see struggle. So shilling love was really an attempt to show how soft words are a luxury that are bought with hard currency.
You have a shilling love part two in the book as well. And that is about your parents, your mother, the general, your father, the foot soldier, trying to come into the United States and the travails they face at immigration. What did it feel like for you at that moment, realizing that you live here, you earn your bread and butter in this country that is treating your own parents so disparagingly?
It's an experience of extraordinary pain. It's a kind of splitting. You have to become schizophrenic. And Vijay Prashad says in the foreword to Migritude, California is a particularly schizophrenic place to be a migrant, which I absolutely agree with. That schizophrenia is also delocalized. It's no longer just based in the US, because I have the experience over and over again when I'm in Kenya of when I go to the US embassy in Kenya as a US citizen now to renew a passport or to do business, and there's a very clear demarcation. People with passports get to walk in and they are our people to the Americans, and their Kenyan parents or, you know, relatives are standing outside and very clearly persona non grata.
What do your Kenyan parents make of their American daughter now that these demarcations have happened?
This was what they worked for and dreamed of and fought for. When I got my American citizenship, my mother said, oh yeah, I called up my parents and said, okay, I've got my citizenship now. And my mother was laughing and crying. And she said, now you're safe. No one can touch you. So for them, American citizenship confers a kind of invulnerability, a Teflon armor.
This notion of being safe because you're American, a lot of that is about how unsafe, especially in East Africa, many Asians felt. And your book, in fact, the chronology of your book starts with Idi Amin in Uganda expelling all Asians. Can you talk a little bit about what happened and why that was so pivotal in people of Indian heritage and their relationship with East Africa?
I grew up in the shadow of Amin's expulsion of the Ugandans from Uganda, of the Ugandan Asians from Uganda. And so the shadow hovering over brown people across East Africa was the same thing could happen to us. We are a targeted minority. We're a visible minority. We could at any moment be expelled, become a racial target. But this notion of safety and Americanness goes further than that, because everywhere in the world now, there is, you know, again, there's a very clear distinction between the value of an American body or a European body and the value of an African or Asian body. One of the most devastating examples of that was the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, which happened in 1997, I believe, or 1998, where the Americans, the U.S. government, basically flew out all its own citizens who were trapped or injured in the bombings and left hundreds of Kenyans buried in the rubble. Those hundreds of Kenyans have never received a penny of compensation, no medical aid, no support, nothing from the US government. It was such a clear and devastating example of which lives count and which ones don't.
When did you first start working on what became Migritude?
Migritude had its genesis in 2005. And so it developed into a one-woman show, which premiered in 2006, then was toured over the next 2 years.
So it's been a while since, and over that period of time, even as you're developing this show and performing it around the world, the climate in the United States for both around empire, war, as well as about immigrants has been changing. And has that change been reflected in the piece, or at least the reaction you get to the piece?
I think it's increased the relevance of the piece. I think immigration was something that people were aware of as a political issue when I began to write this show, make this show in 2005 and 2006. But it was only a segment of people who were more politically conscious of the issues around immigration. Now, immigration is absolutely a red flag. It's a hot button issue. It's been central to the outcome of this election, and it's central to the way that politics and political lines are being drawn in the U.S. So this is absolutely a time for people across the political spectrum and in every class and whatever their standing is in terms of legality and entitlement in America, nobody can be oblivious anymore about immigration.
And why did you choose the title Migritude?
I was seeking a word that would capture the idea of migrant attitude, migrants with attitude, a generation of migrants who do not stay silent or assimilate in order to protect themselves, who speak out lyrically, fiercely, unapologetically, and who claim their space and their difference as a source of power.
Do you see that happening more, or as the attacks on migrants and xenophobia increases, are migrants retreating and being encouraged to be quieter, in fact?
I see, especially in younger generations, a growing level of awareness, of collective action, of politicization, which is extraordinary. It's incredibly empowering. At the Mario Savio lectures in Berkeley, there were young high school students who were undocumented migrants to this country who had been through high school, were born and raised in America, but because they didn't have papers, have no access to college scholarships, are facing deportation. And yet they stood up and they spoke. They outed themselves, which to me was an act of extraordinary political courage and personal courage, and a real testament to their belief that speaking out is what will empower them, not being silent, not disappearing, not going underground.
One of the things that has happened with the immigration movement or the changing trends is that women have actually become the majority of migrants around the world. Mm-hmm. And as a woman immigrant yourself doing this show, how has that changed the narrative around immigration and what people's perceptions are about who a migrant is and why they come here?
I think it has really brought together the issues of labor and migration. It has pointed up the fact that migration is always about labor demands and labor markets, and that barriers to migration are always about controlling the movement of labor, never about controlling the movement of capital, because the central tenet of neoliberalism is capital should be allowed to move freely with no obstruction, but labor absolutely cannot be allowed to move freely. So when we focus the spotlight on women migrants and we understand why they are moving in these huge numbers across the planet, we see absolutely that it's about their labor, whether it's their labor in Iraq, in Europe, in the US, and how central that labor is both to sustaining the societies that we live in the global north. Female labor from the third world is what actually is going to take care of the aging population of America in the next 20 years. It's already taking care of the aging population of America.
Shelda, we started by talking about the trunk of saris that your mother gave you. I was wondering, what did she make of the use you finally put those saris to, and whether doing these pieces and performing on stage has made you rethink saris?
My mother has really supported the show. She had no idea what it was I was doing with these saris when I talked about the show. When she finally saw it, she got it. And I think she felt her legacy and her voice were honored and celebrated. And she loves the response that audiences have to it and to her voice in the show. My journey of making the show was also a journey of rediscovering and reclaiming saris for myself, of beginning to come out as a sari wearer, of learning how to reclaim this thing that I'd rejected and alienated myself from, and enjoy the power and the beauty of wearing saris and of subverting them, of using them in all sorts of ways.
So you don't find them constricting anymore? You can run in them?
I have skills to build. I'm an amateur sari wearer. I'll put it that way. I'm improving.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Shailja Patel is the author of Migritude. She will be at the Kearney Street Workshop in San Francisco on Sunday, December 5th at 6 p.m. This is New America Now. I'm Sandeep Roy. Become a friend on Facebook. Just search for New America Now Radio. From Mormon missionaries in Argentina to a boy dreaming of baseball in Peru. These are just some of the stories in the new issue of the literary magazine Granta. For the first time ever, Granta is putting together a collection of writing from young writers in a language other than English. The language is Spanish. The issue introducing Granta's picks of the best young Spanish language novelists contains 22 authors, few of whom have previously been published in English. Daniel Alarcón himself, author of the award-winning novel Lost City Radio, was selected as one of the best young American novelists by Granta in 2007. And he was one of the translators who helped put together this issue. And he joins us to explain what it's all about. Thanks for coming in, Daniel.
Thank you, Sandeep.
The writers in this issue of Granta were all born in or after 1975. What's significant about that year?
Well, the introduction talks about that being the fall of Franco, which sort of struck me as a little odd. I think it's always interesting and somewhat controversial where you define a generation. I don't know of anyone in Peru who really dates themselves based on the fall of Franco in Spain. But, you know, I think you could easily draw a conclusion that's after the publication of 100 Years of Solitude. And it's kind of the generation that's just after Pinochet assumes power in Chile. And it's the generation that comes immediately after Bolaño's generation. So I think it is an interesting sort of time. And I think you can always sort of try to guess and pinpoint what's important, what date is or isn't. But, you know, it's fairly arbitrary, I would guess.
But as you said, there's been tremendous change happening in Latin America in the last couple of decades, even in the last decade or so. So is the writing that's coming out of that part of the world, is it reflecting those changing winds?
Absolutely. I think it has been for a long time. I think, if anything, there's been in the United States a sort of static picture of what Latin American writing is. And in Latin America, we are very aware of the fact that writing now reflects new realities, new circumstances, much more urban, much more polyglot, much more globalized, perhaps less political or less overtly political, and more in touch with the issues of migration.
Well, also, I imagine that this new generation, many more of them are based in Latin America and writing as opposed to being writers who are in exile in Paris or Madrid or somewhere.
I think you'd be surprised at that. I think exile probably is the wrong word. You know, it conjures up images of political exile, but there's a new kind of exile. You know, a lot of these writers on the list are in the United States getting PhDs in literature at American universities. So I'm not sure that would be called exile. It seems a little
self-selected.
Seems a little dramatic to call it exile, but you know, there's a lot of people living abroad.
Tell us about some of them who are included in this collection. Three of them will be in the Bay Area for the launch of Granta.
The three writers we'll have here are Carlos Yoshimito of Peru, Carlos Labe of Chile, and Andres Felipe Solano of Colombia. Just to speak about Yoshimito, for example, he's Peruvian of Japanese descent, who writes basically almost gangster fiction set in the favelas of Brazil. He's never been to Brazil. It's purely a work of speculative, imaginative writing, but it's very dark, it's very funny, at times violent. And
what does Brazil think about that?
I don't know. That's one of the questions I want to ask him when we talk, because
I mean, we're so sensitive about these issues of cultural appropriation and write what you know.
Yeah, you know, I've always sort of been suspicious of write what you know. I think you should write what you want to know. And Yoshimito, I certainly have lots of questions for him about that. And certainly in Peru, a lot of people have questions for him on this issue as well. It would be interesting to see how he's read in Brazil. He probably hasn't been published in Brazil yet. But there is a fearlessness to it that I appreciate as an artist and respect. And you have a writer like Carlos Labe, who's writing really playful, kind of tricky, even surreal mashups of, on the one hand, like a police detective novel, and on the other hand, kind of almost sci-fi types explorations of drug use and the medical industrial complex, and with a murder mystery thrown in. It's really, really interesting stuff. And he's worked on music, and he's done graphic novels and poetry. And you have Andres Felipe Solano from Colombia, who's worked as a journalist, and clearly his work as a journalist has affected and inspired his work. And he writes kind of a dark comedic take on kind of Bogota and the nightlife of Bogota and relationships in Bogota.
So these writers are all writing about different things that interest them, even writing about places they really don't have firsthand experience of, but about the urban experience, doomed love affairs, things that probably are universal.
Sure.
But do they butt up against expectations here in the United States about what Latin American writing should be about? You know, people here are still with the 100 Years of Solitude.
Yeah, I think inevitably if American writers come to this collection looking for a new García Márquez, they're not going to necessarily find that style present. They will find perhaps an updating of some of the concerns of Márquez. Or an updating of even the kind of fanciful storytelling tone that he creates. There's a lot of great, great writing. And the generation of Márquez is also known for being really politically engaged. And I think that's one of the other sort of weight burdens that Latin American writers have to carry, is like, how political are you? And what I've been finding as I read these texts is politics is very much in the background, but I still sense it, and I still note that its presence, and perhaps the concerns of the previous generation are still there, they're just hidden perhaps slightly more dense and harder to find.
But is it liberating for these writers to not necessarily have everything they write be viewed through this political lens? You know, they're not writing as a blow against a dictatorship or a military right. ruler, but at the same time, having that person to write against, as it were, also automatically gives you a bit of an identity, and, you know, freedom can be a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I think a lot of Latin American writers fight for relevance the same way American writers fight for relevance, and one of the ways to do that historically has been to write against a political situation or document a struggle. There's new ways to do it now, and there's perhaps ways that we might recognize. I think most American writers are engaged with politics, or many American writers are engaged with politics, but you don't necessarily see it in their work, and you have to really tease out the meaning. You can maybe guess how, you know, Jonathan Franzen votes, but it's not the most important thing about Jonathan Franzen's work, you know, just to name an example. And I think for Latin American writers, there's been such a general disenchantment with politics. You know, I can speak specifically about Peru, but I think this is generalized, that ideology has been discredited in a lot of ways. And so there's no burning desire to write, you know, the next great Latin American Marxist novel because, you know, that didn't really do so well for us. So let's look at other ways of approaching art and other ways of approaching life.
Is there a tension with the writers who are writing in Spanish in Latin America and sort of the, I don't know if I would call them the old guard, of the writers who are based in the United States, the diasporan writers who've been writing about those places for a while in their visions of the world?
I mean, there's only a few who have sort of blown up to the point where they cross back and forth.
Let me rephrase this. Do these young writers hate Isabel Allende?
Yes, probably. Maybe the Chileans, you'd have to ask them more directly.
Because in ways, it's the diasporan writer who puts these people in a box.
Sure. I mean, I got to say, I when I've been in Chile and Isabel Allende is mentioned, she does not get a ringing endorsement from the young writers that I know, just to put it in diplomatically. Whether I think Junot Diaz does, for example. Junot Diaz was read in Chile and read in Peru and read in Argentina and read in Mexico, was very well translated by Yachi Ovejas into Spanish, and people really consider him a very, very important writer. And that's, I think, in part because in some ways we're closer. You know, the generation of young writers in the United States and young writers in cities like Lima or Sao Paulo or Mexico City, you know, we have some of the same concerns, and we're sort of playing in the same sandbox in some ways.
Well, thank you very much for introducing this issue to us.
Thank you, Sandeep.
Novelist Daniel Alarcón was one of the translators for the new issue of Granta, featuring the best young Spanish language novelists. Several of the writers, along with Alarcón, will be present at events marking the issue in the San Francisco Bay Area from December 6th through December 8th. You can check out our website, newamericanow.org, for links to those events. Thanks for listening to New America Now, dispatches from the new majority, interethnic, international, and intergenerational news for the new America. New America Now is also available as a podcast. Go to newamericanow.org. Our engineer and technical producer is Eric Wayne. Inga Bookbinder produces the show. New America Now is produced at the KALW Studios in San Francisco by New America Media. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sandeep Roy.